Welcome to the fourth edition of The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. In case you missed the first three shows, in a brief summary, we've established that the corporate and government-driven education, quote, reform movement is really a guise for the privatization of our public schools. It's driven by three foundations, the Gates, Walton, and Broad Foundations, and also by federal laws under No Child Left Behind and now Race to the Top. It's supported by both political parties and is well underway. It involves the Common Core State Standards, which are corporately driven, developmentally inappropriate, and not based on research. Along with the Common Core State Standards is the new annual test called Smarter Balance, which requires districts to spend a lot of money on technology, and involves the new teacher evaluation that is partly linked to the student test results. When enough students at a school don't meet the testing goal, the state can intervene and fire teachers and administrators and turn the school over to a privately owned charter school. Charter schools don't have to answer to school boards. They can select the students they want and generally take less English language learners and special ed students. The record shows that even when they can pick the best students, they don't do any better than the public schools and often do worse. Rupert Murdoch is quoted as saying that public education is a $500 billion market waiting to be tapped. To hear the first three shows that discuss these issues in detail, they're archived at radioforall.net, and that's the digit four. So again, radioforall.net. Once on the site, you can search for the title, The Assault on Public Education, and the show should pop up. With me in the studio today is third-party gubernatorial candidate Jonathan Pelto to discuss why he's running for governor and what he'll do if elected to save public education. Jonathan Pelto, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, now you've just decided to run for governor. Could you tell us why?
I certainly would, and I think it's going to be an important race for voters to watch and hopefully one that will bring voters to the polls in November, because we're going to do this one differently. We've learned what happens when we really stick to just the two-party system. For all intents and purposes in this country, we've now become a one party. It's the incumbency party, and sometimes it's Democrats, and sometimes it's Republicans. And that's not to say that there aren't differences between the two, but the differences are becoming smaller and smaller, and oftentimes there's virtually no difference at all, or that voters are not given real options. And so I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat all my life. On my 18th birthday, I went down to the local town hall and registered as a Democrat. I was a Democratic office holder and a Democratic Party official. But I think personally, the Democratic Party has left its roots and its base. People have said, you're jeopardizing the Democratic victory. My feeling is that it's the Democratic Party that has changed, and they're the ones that are jeopardizing their chances. In a recent interview, I was honored that Ralph Nader said, Jonathan, in support of my candidacy, Ralph Nader said, Jonathan Pelto is not the spoiler, the Democratic and Republican parties are the spoiler. And for someone who was growing up when Ralph Nader was making such a profound difference in this country, and I know I wasn't the only one who wanted to grow up and be like Ralph Nader and make a difference, that here I am, 20 years after leaving politics, returning with a different perspective and wanting to put that perspective before the voters. So I have announced I created a new party called the Education and Democracy Party. I'm in the process of collecting the signatures necessary to get on the ballot in November, and I'm confident that we will be able to get those signatures. We can talk some about the barriers to third-party candidacies. I'm really shocked. I thought I knew a lot about election law. But the systematic and systemic barriers to third parties is really disturbing and shocking. And regardless of what happens in November, I want to come back and propose legislative changes to allow third parties a better access to the political process. That said, we'll be on the ballot. Hopefully, we will have a profound impact. And I've said repeatedly, I'm running to win. And I think that the electorate is fed up with the present system. With people across the political spectrum, I describe myself as a populist or more liberal, But I've been really honored and humbled by people from conservative, moderate, liberals coming forward and saying they wanted to help me get on the ballot and support my candidacy. Because I think that there is a bubbling concern that has come to the surface. Concern, worry, even people being afraid about where this country and where this state is headed. We know that we're off track. We know that this isn't the country or the state that we were born into. We know that the country and state that we're leaving behind for our children isn't going to be one that has the opportunities that we had. And so I'm running on a variety of issues, education, tax policy, higher education, this program where government now has suddenly given away corporate welfare to very successful companies that don't need the money and yet are blackmailing us by saying, if you don't give us money, we'll move to another state. The notion that government is supposed to pick winners and losers in the free enterprise system is as offensive to liberals or conservatives, capitalists, socialists, and everybody in between. Nobody ever thought that government was supposed to be in the job of deciding which private companies succeed and which ones don't. The issue of openness and honesty in government, and the list goes on. So I appreciate this opportunity and any opportunity I can to talk to the voters of Connecticut about these very important issues.
So you also have now chosen your lieutenant governor.
So the way the system works is that you have to first set up a political party, or you can set up a political party. So as I said, mine is the Education and Democracy Party. There's an interesting law that was passed a few years ago by the legislature, signed by the governor, in which they claim that it is illegal to use the word Republican or Democrat in the name of a third party. Now, I know that's unconstitutional, and if I had time, I would have named my, in Minnesota, for example, it's called the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. I would have probably used something like the Democratic Working People's Party or something like that. Instead, I chose the word democracy, partly to see what they would do and partly because it delivered the same message. But it was a good eye-opener that government could say to people seeking office, you cannot use the word Republican or Democrat, as if those were trademarked and not something that the people owned, that it was something that the parties owned. So the first step is, in my case, was to set up a political party and then to start to collect signatures. You need 7,500 signatures to get on the ballot. And you can't start collecting signatures until you have a running mate. So I spoke to a number of people around the state who I felt would bring diversity and a breath of fresh air to the debate. And the candidate who I asked and who agreed, her name is Ebony Murphy. She is a Connecticut native. She lives in Hartford. She's a teacher, African-American, educated at UConn, Yale Campaign School, has won a number of fellowships and awards for her work around ending segregation and supporting diversity and working particularly with teachers of color from both Connecticut and across the country and, in fact, around the world. And so she and I will be giving talks and going to events and doing radio interviews as a way to show the voters that there are ways that we can broaden the debate, that we don't have to have simply the same two parties, the same two people repeating pretty similar things and not giving people choices.
Yeah, I think it was Ralph Nader who once said that the only difference between the Republicans and Democrats now is which one drops to their knees faster when their corporate donors enter the room. So your candidacy brings a real and needed choice to the voters of Connecticut. Now, what's your response been from the public since you've decided to investigate running for governor and now are a candidate?
So I have been involved in politics most of my life. I got involved very early. I ran and won 5 times for the Connecticut General Assembly when I was much younger, rose up to the Deputy Majority Leader of the House, and then left the legislature 21 years ago. I know politics and campaigns. I've worked on and ran many campaigns. I know both how difficult it can be and how rewarding it can be. And I have to say that I was really amazed and, quite frankly, very humbled by the overwhelming support that I've been getting from people who are writing to me or calling. Within the last, I'd say, 2 weeks, more than 500 people have found my email address and written to say that they wanted to help collect petitions or help the campaign. I've worked on some amazing campaigns through the years, and I have never seen 500 people come forward on their own to find an email address, to write, to take the time, to say they wanted to help out. So I'm excited about that. Interestingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, the establishment has been just as serious in trying to stop it or limit it. I have found that a number of groups, including what I would have called progressive groups or union groups, have said that I would not be allowed to speak to their members, would not be allowed to participate in their endorsement process. The American Federation of Teachers, Connecticut chapter, who represent a group of teachers in Connecticut, and I've made education a lifelong issue that I've worked on, and particularly over the last 3 years, where I think I've been the most outspoken opponent of the education reform industry, the corporate education reform industry's attack on public education in Connecticut. The union representing a group of teachers wouldn't even allow me to speak to their political endorsement group or to their executive committee, and instead endorsed Molloy. The AFL-CIO, I was told, would not allow me to speak to their political convention, the AFL-CIO being the coalition of all of the unions. And I had never heard of something like that. I mean, unions that are supposed to be dedicated to free speech and democracy and providing an opportunity for people to be heard and standing on the side of the working men and women of our state, and wouldn't even allow me to come and present my case. So I found it both sides. I mean, the number of people who have come out to offer their support has been incredible, and the reaction by the establishment has been equally incredible. It reiterates why we need to move forward. It reiterates the gap that has taken place between so-called leaders and the rank and file. And I think that this campaign, I hope that this campaign will be a vehicle for people to say enough is enough and we need to start talking about these issues. The corporate attack on education, I think, is a perfect example. We've covered that very well in the last three shows that you've done and really shown what's happened in this country. As you said, that Rupert Murdoch, the media mogul, called public education a $500 billion untapped economic market. The Common Core, the Common Core testing, the privatization of schools are all part of a national strategy that started with George W. Bush, was dramatically expanded under President Obama, that basically is designed to tell the vast majority of children that they're failing when our schools have lots of issues, but our public school system is not failing. Our graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in the history of our country. Our test scores, for what it's worth, are the highest they've ever been in the history of the country. We don't have a problem with public education. What we have is what's called an achievement gap, and that achievement gap is because the three primary factors that influence academic success, that determine whether a child can really make it through and get the skills that they need to go to college or to enter the workplace, the barriers are poverty, language barriers, and unmet special education needs. And every parent, rich or poor, English speaking or not, with a special needs child or not, know that when you go to school, when a poor child goes to school, if they're hungry, if they come from a household that's not functioning in a way that there are parents there that can help them do their homework, either because of language barriers or because the parents are working so many different jobs or a single parent household, then those children don't do as well because you can't learn when you're hungry. You can't learn when you're scared. You can't learn when you don't have a safe place to go home to, or that there's violence on the streets, or that there's nobody home to help you out with your homework. The language barriers are equally significant. Here in Connecticut, we could be doing something about it. In Hartford, half the children go home to households that don't speak English as their primary language. One in four children are not proficient in English. And instead of really dealing with that problem, which we could be by providing stronger English as a second language, bilingual, dual language programs, things that have worked, instead we're cutting those programs back and leaving those children really without any opportunity to succeed. And then the last, and one I think that parents, urban or suburban, understand, is that there are lots of children that have special educational needs. Many of them are incredibly smart, can succeed very well with the proper support. In suburban districts like mine, every classroom has an instructional assistant, and most classrooms have a special education instructional assistant. So as children fall behind, children need extra help, they get that help. In our urban areas, they don't have the money because we have such a bad education funding system, they don't have the money to provide those kinds of supports. The city of Bridgeport, for example, in a budget-cutting move, did away with all instructional assistants. They did away with almost all of their guidance counselors, and they did away with almost all of their school librarians. Now, in my town, virtually every classroom has one or two instructional assistants. We have guidance counselor or special ed teachers. I think in my school, there's two special education teachers for 200 students. In Bridgeport, there was one special education teacher for 800 students. And now we're seeing more and more school districts that don't have a librarian, don't have a library. And the problem is that the way in which we fund our schools has actually been determined to be unconstitutional. There's a very important case that went to the Supreme Court called CJEF v. REL. The name of it is not necessarily as important as the topic. And what the Supreme Court said was that our children, Connecticut children, whether suburban or rural or urban, have a constitutional right to a quality education that prepares them for college, workplace, and democracy. When it comes to Connecticut's constitution, it's actually one of the strongest and best in the country about the importance of education. Many states just say there shall be a free, comprehensive education system. Ours actually goes well beyond that and says not only will there be a free education system, but that it shall provide students with the tools and the knowledge to be able to get jobs, to go to college, to participate in democracy. Really, the problem is the state is not providing the resources that are necessary, and so this court case is now pending. The Governor Malloy and his State Department of Education and the Attorney General have been trying to get the case dismissed when they really should be working to find a solution to it. But many, many listeners will probably vaguely remember the term. The goal was 50-50, meaning 50% of funds would come from the state, 50% would come from local towns to pay for their schools. The more that comes from local towns, the heavier the burden is on the property tax, because that's the way the towns get their taxes, is through the property tax. And when you have an unfair school funding system, the burden gets too great on the property tax owner. And there are lots of towns that just simply cannot come up with enough money. So the plan was to move Connecticut to what was called 50-50, 50% of the money for local schools from the state, 50% from the towns. On average, some towns would get more, some towns would get less, depending on how rich or poor they were. When we passed the income tax in 1991, it was in part to move us to that goal. We've been slipping backwards ever since. And this case, this CJEF v. REL case, which has gone to the Supreme Court and is now back in the court to decide a solution, is proof that Connecticut's education funding system is inadequate, is inappropriate, and in fact is unconstitutional. Hopefully, we'll have a governor who will try to resolve that issue instead of dismiss it and pretend it's not there, because the more the state backs away from its commitment, the more local property taxes go up. And it's discriminatory, it's unfair, it hits the middle class far more than anybody else. And in Connecticut, for example, the middle class pay about 10% of their money in state and local taxes. The rich pay about 5 or 6%, and the poor about 12%. Connecticut has what's called a perfectly regressive tax structure. It's just about as un-American as one can get. In 2011, when Governor Malloy introduced his $1.5 billion record-breaking tax increase, the income tax rate went up for everybody except for those making more than $1 million. He wanted to protect millionaires from having to pay any more taxes. And what he said at the time in a speech before the Connecticut General Assembly was that he didn't want to punish success. Well, asking people to pay their fair share in taxes is not punishing success. Asking people to pay their fair share is an American ideal that has been around for a very long time. And one of the most important issues that would be a priority for me, should I become governor, would be to design a system in which taxes are fairer. Just to give a quick snapshot, we could actually increase the tax on the wealthiest by a fairly significant amount, 2%, let's say, and they would still be paying less than they would be paying in Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Manhattan. What Malloy and others have said is that if we ask the rich to pay their fair share, they'll leave Connecticut. And it's a scare tactic, and the middle class is paying the price. And so all of us are having higher property taxes because the rich are getting away without paying their fair share. And that's just wrong.
And if they did leave the state, wouldn't it be healthier to have smaller businesses come in and pick up where they've left off?
That's right. Well, you know, and the fact is they won't leave the state because the property tax and income taxes are higher in other states, that these wealthy people are doing just fine and they can pay a little bit more and they'll still be doing just fine. But what your reference is a very good one about small businesses versus large businesses. And it really reflects what's happening in this country of people forgetting the importance of small business. When I left the legislature, I set up my own small business, a public relations company. I had it for 17 years. I usually had 5 to 10 employees, and I paid for their salary and their health benefits and retirement and all of the things that small businesses do. Some years were better, some years were worse. And then I also had a couple of other small businesses, a little retail store and some other things. And I closed those, and I closed them not because the taxes were too high. Quite frankly, I felt like if the state says that I need to pay 10%, then I'll pay the 10%. The problem was that all of the forms and all of the regulations made it impossible for me to be able to make a living. And instead of solving those problems, and in this day and age with computerization and everything else, we could make it very simple to have a successful small business. And we could be taxing those businesses at a fair rate, and businesses would know that, you know, I need to pass enough of those taxes through to the consumer that I can keep my business going and pay my employees. And instead of doing that, what Governor Malloy and the Democrats, looking very much like Republicans, have engaged in this massive corporate welfare program where we're giving hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to very successful companies and leaving small businesses dangling in the wind, where the government is, as I said, picking winners and losers, and they're picking the companies that would have succeeded anyway and not helping the companies that could stay in business and keep jobs and grow jobs. You don't have to read all the newspaper every day to hear what some of these are. The most famous one under Governor Malloy was this business where we gave a company called Bridgewater, the largest hedge fund in the world, their headquarters in Westport. We gave them $120 million in tax breaks so that they would move from Westport to Stamford. That $120 million could have, if, as an alternative, when we say, for example, that if you put a second person in the classroom, if you put somebody, a college-educated person, to help the students that are falling behind, those instructional aids don't make a lot of money, $20,000 or $25,000 a year. They should make more. They don't, but they're a very inexpensive, very effective way to provide support. The $120 million, had we decided to use that to put an instructional assistant in every classroom that needed one, we could have truly changed the direction of children's lives. Instead, we gave it to Bridgewater Hedge Fund. Now, the CEO of Bridgewater, a guy named Ray Dalio, he made $2.3 billion last year. He was the highest paid American. Paid $2.3 billion, not over his lifetime got $2.3 billion. He literally made $2.3 billion in 1 year. And we middle-class taxpayers ended up having to pay more, and small businesses had to pay more, so that somebody like Ray Dalio could pay less. And if that's not a sign of what's wrong with this.
And they call it a free market, but it's really corporate welfare, as you said. There's no free market out there.
That's right. It's corporate welfare at its worst because, I mean, you look at who got the money. Some companies, you know, one could say, well, you know, we like those companies. For example, we gave ESPN a whole lot of money for a studio that they basically were going to build anyway. I think it's fantastic to have ESPN in Bristol. They bring us jobs. They bring prominence to the state. But does it make sense for taxpayers to pay more so that ESPN can be more successful? Cigna, which left the state, they are in the state, but their quote-unquote headquarters moved to Philadelphia. But their CEO lived in Connecticut, so he flew to outside of Philadelphia, and he flew there every week. But his family was here in Connecticut. So we gave them, I think, close to $40 million in order to get them to move the name of their headquarters back to Connecticut so that the president could then be here in Connecticut at its headquarters instead of living in Connecticut and flying to Pennsylvania to be in their headquarters. Now, being able to say that Cigna's headquarters in Connecticut, is it worth that kind of money? No, it's not worth that kind of money when we have the kinds of problems that we have in the state. And the list goes on and on and on. Right. And it really is, I think, something that all voters should be concerned about, not only because we end up paying higher taxes, not only because we corrupt the free enterprise system by saying your company will be successful while all the others won't be, but adding insult to injury, perhaps the greatest insult of all, was that Malloy put almost all of this corporate welfare on the state's credit card. So we now will be on the hook for this money, plus the interest over the next 20 years. And so we'll be paying for it and our children will be paying for it. These companies will have made billions or maybe even left the state and we'll still be paying for the corporate welfare. People may remember we gave money to Pfizer to build a headquarters, a research headquarters in New London. They built a beautiful building. It required them to stay in Connecticut for 10 years. And when the 10 years were up, they moved out of state. And there is a massive, beautiful building sitting primarily empty, paid for by the taxpayers. We will be paying for that building for the next 20 years or 15 years. And Pfizer took the money and ran. And that's what these companies will do, laughing all the way to the bank. And so we, at the very least, need a campaign in which we say to the Republicans and Democrats, you're not going to get our votes as long as you keep up this kind of irresponsible budgeting.
Right, because they're responsive to the corporations and not to the people and the people's needs. And that's why it's refreshing to have you in the race, because I see that you care more about people than you do corporations, which is what we need. Jonathan, so let me ask you, if you were elected governor, what would you do differently than Governor Malloy?
The most important thing is that government should be honest with people. And I'm picking on Governor Malloy because he's presently the governor, but I'd say many of these same things about the Republican candidate, or if there was a Republican governor, I'd be saying the same thing. First and foremost, the single most important thing is that government should be honest. The other day, Malloy said that there will not be a deficit, that he will not need to ask for any concessions from state employees, and there will be no tax increases, that he will not propose or accept any tax increases during his 4 years of his second term. You know, if he was Pinocchio, his nose would have gone into the next room. We are facing a $1.3 billion deficit in the next year's budget. The way the budget has been structured is so full of gimmicks that we will have a massive deficit that we're going to have to talk about everything, including budget cuts, changing priorities of moving money around, and getting additional revenue. The question is not whether taxes are going to have to go up. The question is, are they going to go up on people who can afford to pay and not on the middle class who are already overburdened? So when you have a governor who, and I don't use this term lightly, but will straight out lie to the people, you've got a real problem. So in answer to your question of what I would do differently, I think the biggest thing is that you have to trust the people to be able to handle the truth. And if you don't want the people to have the truth, then don't run, don't be in government, don't put yourself in a position where you're going to be lying to people. So we have big problems. That's the first thing I would do. The second thing I'd say is there are both short-term and medium-term solutions. In the short term, it's relatively inexpensive, like, for example, the idea of instructional assistance as opposed to giving $120 million in corporate welfare to one company. Let's use that money to actually change children's lives. The second is that the demographics of this state are changing. We have lots of children that are coming into school with language barriers that need to be addressed, many speaking Spanish, but many other languages as well. In Hartford, children are coming in with 107 different languages. We are the great melting pot. We're the great experiment of the world, our democracy and our system. And if we want it to succeed, we're going to have to be prepared to help children. We're going to have to be more aggressive in helping children learn English and also learn the skills in the languages that they use and then transfer that over to English. So, for example, one of the problems is we start teaching science traditionally in third grade and we start testing them in fifth grade. And we're teaching them in English. They're going home to households that don't speak English. We're testing them in English and they're failing. We know that some of the greatest scientists in the world have not been English speakers. It's not like English magically helps you learn science. We should be teaching those children science in their own language sometimes so that they will learn the science and then as we teach them English as well. So short term, there are a number of things that we could be doing to make a real difference. The other is we need to get rid of this Common Core and the Common Core testing. It is a huge waste of time, waste of money, and actually puts us on the wrong direction. There's nothing wrong with standards. They claim that it's the Common Core standards to improve education. Connecticut actually has pretty good standards. We could improve those, and there's a way to do that. And the Common Core is that there will be the same standards in every state in the country. Theoretically, there's nothing wrong with us trying to align our standards, but there is real differences between Connecticut and Louisiana, and I'm not sure that our standards have to be exactly the same as Louisiana's. And so instead of spending all of our time trying to get these Common Core standards, and more importantly, the Common Core testing, where it requires computers for every child because the tests are on computer instead of on paper. So we'll need computers for every child. We'll need more internet bandwidth. Again, schools should have computers. They should have internet bandwidth, but to devote all of the resources to that. And then all of the testing to get ready for the testing, in essence, what the Common Core has done is it's turning our schools into little more than testing factories. That what I hear from teachers and parents and students is there's more testing and less learning. So instead of wasting the money on the Common Core and the Common Core testing, our schools could get a much bigger bang for the buck, so to speak, if they were using those to preserve the key programs and refocusing on what really matters. In the midterm is this issue of changing the funding formula. Again, it won't happen overnight. Connecticut is in a difficult fiscal situation. We're not going to solve the problem in 1 year. But instead of fighting this lawsuit, if the governor would sit down with all of the various people interested in this issue and come up with a funding formula that was fair, equitable, constitutional, and implemented that over the course of the next 10 years, we could see a very different school system 10 years from now. So on education, I actually think that the governor is 100% wrong. The Republican candidate is almost as wrong. I hear people say, well, the Republican is worse. I think actually on education, the governor, the incumbent governor, Democrat, is worse, but the Republican isn't far behind. But we can pick the right route. We don't have to go the route that these two guys are telling us. So that would be the first thing that I would do is get rid of the Common Core, get rid of the Common Core testing, put the money where it makes more sense, and then solve the funding formula problem that Connecticut is facing.
Yeah, and didn't in Race to the Top, I mean, I know that 100% of our state congressional members voted for the Common Core, and this, based on the Race to the Top, President Obama's program, with the idea that there, a lot of funding was going to come with that, and then the funding didn't come with it. So we have this horrible system in place, and we didn't get any of the money. Can you speak
That's
to that?
That's right. No, yeah. You have it exactly right. It was federal blackmail. What they said, and what's so interesting about it, is that it was bipartisan. Lots of voters, in part because we're taught from very young and taught in school that we have a two-party system and that the parties are really different. When it comes to this corporate education reform industry, this sort of massive juggernaut that is taking taxpayer money out of the public school system by new software, new testing software, consultants, new computers, new internet. There was a very wealthy town in Connecticut that had enough money to do all of its renovations. And last year, it had to shift its entire budget just to buy new computers because the computers that it had bought the year before were not compliant with the new testing scheme. So the education reform industry is laughing all the way to the bank. So what is the education reform industry? It was created by policies set up by George W. Bush under No Child Left Behind and then dramatically expanded under President Obama under Race to the Top. You hear sometimes on TV, on Fox News, people say, well, you know, Common Core is a creation of Obama. It's a creation of the Bush-Obama administration. It's one and the same when it comes to education. And they got away with it by saying that if everybody agreed, had to agree to using it, they would then shovel a bunch of money to the states. The state of Connecticut has tried three times to get Race to the Top grants and has lost every time. There's been some Race to the Top money at the local level, but not a lot. But instead of saying to our congressional delegation, your job is to represent Connecticut, you need to go down there and exempt Connecticut from having to go through these bad policies in order to get money. The concept of the federal government says that we need to do this in order to get money, then we don't need representatives to vote for that. We need representatives and senators who are going to do the exact opposite and say, I'm here to represent Connecticut, not the federal government. So one of the first things as governor I would do is call them in and say, look, we're pulling out of the Common Core. And states are doing it all across the country. Just within the last couple of weeks, state of Oklahoma officially pulled out of the Common Core. There's about seven other states that are going through some form of pulling out of the Common Core. Some are playing games. Some are actually doing it. But Kansas, South Carolina, Indiana, other states, because they're realizing that it's bad public policy and it's a waste of funds. What the response from President Obama's administration is, well, then you're going to lose money. And my feeling is we pull in our senators and our representatives and say, you need to go to Washington and get us exempted because we have a right to decide what's best for our children. And the federal government shouldn't be saying, and by the way, you're not going to get any money if you don't do that. So education has been a key issue. It's not the only issue. As I said, taxes are another really important one. I think there's a whole lot of us out there who are realizing that when it comes to tax policy, things have just gone haywire, that the middle class is being crushed. And when you crush the middle class, you eliminate the possibility of upward mobility, people getting better lives, the notion of going to college, getting a degree, working hard, getting married, having children, buying a home, all of the things that were sort of the American dream are put in jeopardy when you crush the middle class. And that statistic that I used of the middle class being disproportionately hurt, paying of their share of total income almost twice what the rich are paying, then you say, you know, that's just not the kind of America that was meant to be. So taxes are an important issue. Mm-hmm. Another issue that I've been spending a lot of time talking about is higher education, because I think that we all know that in the 21st century, our children are going to need to have additional skills, additional knowledge, additional understanding in order to compete. And this governor actually put through the deepest cuts to Connecticut's public colleges and universities in history. It is, in essence, a tax increase, because when you cut funding for public colleges and universities, tuition goes up. And when tuition goes up, it hits, again, disproportionately the middle-income families who just can't come up with the money to send their children to college. UConn, Connecticut State University, even our community and technical colleges are getting more and more expensive. And instead of figuring out ways to promote children going to college, they give it lip service, but they actually have cut the funding for public colleges and universities. And that's leaving people either unable to go or increasing the problem with student debt, which is nearly as bad. I mean, a student who comes out looking for a $50,000 job but has $200,000 or $100,000 in debt and will never be able to buy a house because they can't afford the mortgage payments, again, is exactly the opposite of what was supposed to be the American dream.
Right. Now, at the federal level, transparency in government seems to be a thing of the past, that there's more and more secrecy going on. Do you see the same thing happening at the state level? And if so, what would you do to change that?
Unfortunately, we are seeing the same thing. There's a sense of arrogance and entitlement on the part of our elected officials that they don't have to be held accountable. Again, we see this with both Democrats and Republicans in Connecticut, because we have a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature. We see that they've fallen down on the job in a very big way. We have a number of agencies at the state level that are dedicated to ensuring transparency, openness, honesty, holding people accountable. The Freedom of Information Commission, the Ethics Commission, the State Elections and Enforcement Commission, the State Contracting Board are all there to make sure that government is held accountable. And what we've seen in the last 4 years is significant cuts to their budget and attempts to take away their independence. And much of it has been done in a very devious manner, but that putting people who are political appointees in charge of controlling the actions of what are supposed to be independent agencies. And if people said, if there's one thing that you could do to change government and the direction that we're headed, I'd actually say, although I'm very interested talking a lot about education and higher education and tax policy, the one thing that we could do that would make a difference is to return those agencies to their independent status. Because all of these no-bid contracts that we hear about, all of the suspicions of ethics problems, all of campaign finance violations, all of the business done in secret behind closed doors, if there were agencies that were properly funded and truly independent, they would be putting a stop to it. People complain a lot about those Roland years where he wanted contracts to go to certain people who, it turned out, were giving him things like hot tubs. He went to prison for that, as he should have. He's a convicted felon because he traded government favors for personal favors. I don't know that that's what we're seeing here, but we're seeing in some ways something even worse. We're seeing government function in secret. I've been watching government now for 4 decades, and I have never seen as many what are called no-bid contracts. It was supposed to be used as a very, in extreme circumstances, particularly in emergencies where you didn't have time to put something out to bid, or there really was only one entity that could provide the product or the service for some particular reason. I write a blog called Wait What on my blog site, on my website, jonathanpelto.com, and I've been doing that for the last 3 years. And I have identified dozens and dozens of no-bid contracts in multiple agencies for absolutely no reason other than to give certain people hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of business without having to go through competitive bidding. When you don't go through competitive bidding, when you don't have an open bidding process, you know that you're going to be spending more because nobody's there to hold you accountable for what you're charging. There's a reason that we ended up back in the 80s with the $500 toilet seats, and that was there was nobody minding the store. We're on that path again. And so, as I said, if there was one thing that I would say, what would change government the most? It would be having agencies who were properly funded and given the independence to go after the executive branch or any other branch of government that is doing something wrong. Now, politicians don't want to do that. And I understand. I mean, you know, who wants somebody looking over your shoulder? But it has
to
happen.
For the greater good, we need to do that.
For the greater good. Yeah. And again, I think it's indicative, and I don't mean to sound like an alarmist. I don't mean to sound conspiratorial that, you know, everything is controlled. But I have to say that the lack of transparency and honesty in government at the federal level and at the state level, I mean, at the federal level, we know that government is engaged in illegal spying at a level that has never occurred in American history before. We don't know how bad it is, but we know it's really bad. And we're engaged in illegal practices around the world, whether it's drones or other kinds of illegal activities. And it just is day in and day out. We're seeing some of the same kinds of things going on at the state level, the arrogance, the entitlement that somehow government is above the law, as opposed to mm-hmm. that the law is for controlling, making sure that government is not out of control, and making sure that people who break the law are held accountable. And so that really is something that we've got to come to grips with, or we're going to lose the mm-hmm. country that we care about. Yeah.
Let me ask you another question sort of along those lines. Recently, Arne Duncan came to speak, and all our politicians were there, so I happened to be there, and I asked Chris Murphy about charter schools, and I said how I was concerned that it's a privatization of public schools, and his response was, well, they're not private schools, he said. So where is he coming from? Is he just misinformed, or what's going on there?
Well, in that particular case, he's just misinformed. I mean, why politicians would not know?
Yeah, he looked like he genuinely believed they weren't private schools.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, they are private entities that are running schools funded 100% by, or virtually 100% by the taxpayers. So in that sense, we pay for it. The public pays for the school. We just don't have any control over the school. They're not accountable to a local board of education, for example. They get a charter that is 5 years long. There have been a couple of charter schools in Connecticut that have gotten into some trouble. There have been many around the country. And if you go onto your computer and go to Google or any other search engine and you type in charter schools and indictment, you'll see that there are dozens of charter school operators that are being indicted for stealing money. We haven't seen that yet in Connecticut, but we have seen schools get into trouble. And what the State Board of Education has done is when they come up for renewal, they give them a 3-year charter instead of a 5-year extension. That really means that a charter school can go 8 years without ever having to be accountable to anybody, versus imagine a local school district, a principal or a superintendent or a local school, not having to go through an annual process of getting your budget approved, of people coming to public hearings, of having a board of education that you elect to represent you and set policy. Charter schools have none of that. So in that sense, they are private entities. In Connecticut, they are nonprofit entities for the most part, although they pay their CEOs quite a bit. In other parts of the country, they're actually for-profit charter schools. They're very different than what are called magnet schools. The easiest way to describe it is a charter school is a private company running a school that's paid for by the public to educate public school students. A magnet school is really a regional school. There are actually two different kinds of magnets, but they report to a board. They have public accountability. They receive public funds. They educate only public school students from multiple towns. Magnet schools and charter schools were both supposed to be ways to decrease racial isolation, to bring in kids from a broad area so that you brought in minorities, non-minorities, students from urban areas, non-urban areas. My daughter went to a magnet school in Hartford and was very diverse education, and it was a great program run, the Arts Magnet School in Hartford, run by CREC, the Regional Education Service Center of the Greater Hartford Area. They pull students from dozens of schools. Charter schools pull students just from one area. And so in Connecticut, all of the charter schools are actually, these privately run charter schools, are actually more racially segregated than the towns that they're in. The magnet schools are much more racially diverse, particularly these crack magnet schools. They tend to be about one-third white, one-third black, one-third Latino. So magnet schools are a really good solution for reducing racial isolation and reducing segregation and providing students with the opportunity to focus in on particular areas. So we have magnet schools for the arts, we have magnet schools for science, we have magnet schools for aerospace, we have magnet schools for nursing. Charter schools are, for all intents and purposes, a private school. It just happens that we, the taxpayers, have to pay for it as opposed to the students and the company that would support that private school.
So, Jonathan, could you speak a little bit about Stephan Pryor, the Connecticut Commissioner of Education, and his connection to charter schools.
And Malloy's Commissioner of Education, Stephen Pryor, is a primary example of what I mean when we talk about the corporate education reform industry. It's somebody who doesn't have an educational background, hasn't taught, hasn't been trained as a teacher, hasn't gone through a teacher training program and gotten their certification. He has been a longtime supporter of charter schools. He co-founded a company called Achievement First. Achievement First now has schools in New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. The head of Achievement First is a multimillionaire. Most of the board members of Achievement First are hedge fund managers or other corporate executives. They are as interested in private education as they are public education. Just this last week, the head of Achievement First was named as the new head of New York University, the private university in New York, that great university, private university, that really shows the kind of management structure that these charter schools have. Their boards are made up of people who are very wealthy, who don't send their children to public school and don't live in the towns where the charter schools are at. So Stephen Pryor was a co-founder of Achievement First. He was very involved in the creation of the charter school management company. He resigned from their board of directors only days before he became Commissioner of Education. And his number one effort has been to promote the expansion of charter schools in Connecticut. We have had a number of new charter schools. Existing charter schools have been given more spaces. Probably the single best example of that is in this year's budget, despite all the financial problems, they came up with money to increase funding for the existing charter schools. They came up with money to expand the existing charter schools. They came up with money for new charter schools, and they put in so little money for the magnet schools that they will not be able to open a number of the magnet schools that are ready to open, and they won't even be able to maintain the existing number of students going to magnet schools. So they put their money, because of Stephen Pryor and Governor Malloy, they put their money into these privately run schools at the expense of the public magnet schools. And this is now a person who is in charge of education in Connecticut, and you see it across the country, where they are corporate executives who have little to no educational background, who have really no idea of what it's like. I don't think that they would last a day. I don't even think they'd last an hour in a public school because they wouldn't know how to deal with all of the different issues and problems and diversity and strengths and weaknesses that occur in our schools. They are, for all intents and purposes, trained in private schools and then think that that gives them the right to run our public schools.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your take on tenure. So in California recently, there was a judge who ruled against teacher tenure, essentially taking it away from the state of California. Can you talk about that, and do you see that happening here?
There's a push across the country to do away with tenure. Tenure is the requirement that there be a due process rights for teachers. It developed for a number of reasons, tenure did over the years, but one of the most important reasons that it developed was the notion of academic freedom. That what you don't want is a system in which a school board or a principal or a superintendent can say, I just don't like your political views, or I don't like you, and just simply fire them. And so, in essence, it's a contract. Tenure is a contract that says, if you work in Connecticut, if you work for 4 years and you are deemed to be proficient, you will then become a tenured teacher. You can still get rid of tenured teachers, but there's a set of procedures that you have to go through, and they have to have done something to be fired. These corporate executives really want schools to be much more like businesses, where you just walk in and you say, you know, you're gone, you're gone, you're gone. And both it's unfair, inappropriate. And also, when somebody has gone through an education program to become a teacher, is a trained teacher, is working in a school system, I don't think it's too much to say, and has shown that they're capable because they've worked in there for 4 years without tenure, where they could have been fired at any point or at the end of any year. I don't think it's saying too much that you get to be a teacher unless you do something wrong, and when we want to fire you, we have to go through a process. So this case in California is the first time recently that a judge has ruled that tenure was illegal. That is, that teachers did not have the right to any due process protections, is really, for all intents and purposes, what the judge ruled. Now, politicians, unions, politicians across the country are condemning the ruling. What's so strange about politicians condemning it is that here in Connecticut, when Dan Malloy introduced his education reform bill in 2012, he called for doing away with all tenure, and he called for repealing collective bargaining rights for teachers in what are called turnaround schools, two things that no Democrat in the country had ever proposed, which really says where his heart is when it comes to issues like due process and the right to collectively bargain and the right to union. He says one thing and he does another. So it's been a real eye-opener because this California judge, very conservative judge, the case is being appealed. It's a long way from taking place, but there is a debate going around the country about do teachers deserve any kind of job protection? And we happen to have a governor who is on record as saying, no, they don't deserve job protection and they don't deserve to have the right to collectively bargain. That's what his policy it was. But what his rhetoric is that he goes before all different kinds of groups, including teachers, and says, I'm with you. My mother was a union member. I'm for unions. I'm for collective bargaining. I'm for due process, when in fact what he proposed was exactly the opposite. The economy is changing. There's no question about that. What used to be lifetime jobs are no longer lifetime jobs. You'd go and you'd work at Electric Boat or Pratt & Whitney, and you knew that if you did your job well, you would be there for your entire career and you'd retire with a pension. Those days are slipping away. That doesn't mean that we should swing to the other extreme and say people don't have due process rights. You shouldn't be able to simply fire somebody for no reason at all. And that's particularly true in the area of education because, as we know, or as any teacher knows, you want to be judged on your ability to teach. You may have political ideas, you may have social ideas, you may dress in such a way that somebody doesn't like you. They shouldn't be able to fire you for anything other than your teaching quality. And that's really what tenure is for, is to say, you can fire somebody, but you got to explain why.
And let me ask you also about the teachers' unions. Are they doing anything to fight this Common Core and the race to the top and all of that, or where are they at?
Yeah, you know, the Common Core came along so quickly, and there was so much money promised behind it that almost everybody lined up in favor of the Common Core. The Gates Foundation, which you mentioned in your opening, not only funded the development of the Common Core, and the states all adopted the Common Core before it had even been developed. So imagine, Connecticut had very strong standards, Massachusetts has very strong standards, New York has good standards in math and English and all of the other areas. Along comes an entity that says, we have new standards, but we're not going to tell you what they are, and we want you to adopt them. And if you adopt them, we will give you money. And 44 states adopted those standards without seeing them. The other thing that Gates did was that he then paid groups to sell the Common Core, to back it. The League of Women Voters, the National PTA Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, the NAACP. He went out and, you know, when you're Bill Gates, you can buy anything. And he went through and paid every conceivable group money in order to sell the idea of something that hadn't been created yet. So the unions were really in a difficult position, I guess, a position of their own making, much like many other groups, and that is they had accepted money to tell their members that the Common Core was good. And it's only recently that the union leadership has started to come to grips with that problem. Technically, both of the major unions are still on record of supporting the Common Core, even though teachers across the country know that the Common Core is a joke and a waste of money and a waste of time and moves us in the wrong direction. So how do you get a situation in which the leaders are on one side and all of the members on the other? You do that in part because they thought that it was a way to get a lot of money for their organization. And they got a lot of money for them. I mean, Bill Gates gave millions and millions of dollars to very good organizations who then agreed to do something that was very bad. And they're still having problems dealing with that.
So, Jonathan, we're almost out of time. Is there anything you want to say to the listeners about your campaign or how they can get in touch with you or help out if they want?
Yeah, the easiest way is probably to contact me through my website, jonathanpelto.com, JonathanPelto.com. And you'll find a contact, and we'll be gearing it up so it'll be more and more like a campaign website where you'll be able to give money or help or volunteer. But most importantly, I'd ask voters to pay attention. This election, there's only about another 140 days. It's a relatively short period of time by political terms. I mean, you've got candidates that run for 4 or 8 or 10 years trying to win a seat. We only have less than 5 months to this campaign is over. And I would ask voters to make a special effort to read the newspapers, listen to the news, pay attention, because this is our chance to be heard. And I would welcome everybody's support. I would appreciate people's support. And most importantly, I'd appreciate them participating, because this is really a unique opportunity for us in Connecticut to tell the establishment that it's time for a change.
Thank you, Jonathan, for being on the show.
Thank you.
And I want to let people know that you'll be speaking this evening, Monday, June 30th, on the topic of the privatization of our public schools at 7 p.m. at the Quaker Meeting House at 144 South Quaker Lane in West Hartford. So again, that's 7 p.m. at 144 South Quaker Lane in West Hartford, and the event is sponsored by the Connecticut Coalition for Peace and Justice. If you'd like to learn more or get involved, here are some websites in addition to Jonathan's that you can check out. One is unitedoptout.com. And then we have dianeravitch.com. And Ravitch is R-A-V-I-T-C-H. So dianeravitch.com. Then we have networkforpubliceducation.org. So again, networkforpubliceducation.org. And the last one I'm going to give you today is parentsacrossamerica.org. And again, that's parentsacrossamerica.org. And I'm going to close the show today with the first part of a song by Van Morrison called Educating Archie. And here it is.
Tell me what happened to you.